Coming up on the program today, from the oil industry, a sad end to a life built on the fracking boom. From the steel industry, the beginning, perhaps, of a tariff boom. And a special series on healthcare and human trafficking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is March the 2nd, Wednesday. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We start today in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, from where in the past 24 hours there have come two stories that have shaken the U.S. energy industry. First, word late yesterday that Aubrey McClendon, the former CEO of Chesapeake Energy, the second largest producer of natural gas in this country, had been indicted on charges that he conspired to rig the bids that the company made to buy oil and gas leases in Oklahoma. And then this afternoon, news that McClendon had been killed in a single car crash in Oklahoma City. Marketplace's Scott Tong has been covering both McClendon and Chesapeake Energy for us for years. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So remind us who Aubrey McClendon was.
Well, America's fracking natural gas boom of the last decade has a lot of fathers, and he's one of them. I mean, they're geologists, they're engineers, but as far as businessmen, executives, he's at the top of the list. Aubrey McClendon, he founded Chesapeake Energy, based in Oklahoma City, and turned it into a titan of a natural gas company, one of the most aggressive, one of the most risk-taking companies ever in this space. I mean, he began as what they call a landman, a salesman who goes door-to-door on behalf of a drilling company trying to get people to lease their land so the company can drill. And that's what he was a showman and a landman. He was all Oklahoma City. I went there and asked people about him there. And they said, that's what Oklahomans are. They're frontier people. You stake a claim of land, make a big bet on yourself, and you go big. And he went big, and he succeeded big.
And it was actually those land deals, the alleged bid rigging, that the Department of Justice came down with yesterday, right?
That's right. What is alleged is his company went, and they colluded with other companies to say, you know, I'm going to bid, you're not going to bid, and we're going to keep the prices down to get as many pieces of land as possible at the lowest price possible. But that was the Chesapeake model, is to get as much land as cheaply as possible and to go big and produce as much as possible.
So that said, in the half minute or so we have left, what is McClendon's legacy and what is the legacy of this company now?
Well, America is a natural gas titan, you know, whether you like it or you don't. And he's at the center of that story. I mean, not the oil story, but the natural gas story. And natural gas in this country is gradually pushing out coal in the electricity system, and coal is dirtier. In one interview, he argued, if you are against gas, you are for coal. And so he's part of that story, larger than life, flamboyant, public, unapologetic. One analyst told me today his company was built for a boom. Of course, now, situation's different.
Aubrey McClendon dead today at the age of 56. Scott Tong, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The fracking boom that Aubrey McClendon helped create led in part to the global oil glut that's squeezing so many oil-producing countries now, as we've been talking about the past couple of weeks. Today, the Russian Energy Ministry announced that Russia and several OPEC countries had agreed to freeze production levels at the same levels they were at in January. The idea being that if they don't pump more, the crude surplus we've now got is going to eventually be absorbed and eventually prices will rise. $50 a barrel has become the agreed-upon magic number that might bring some stability to the oil business. And then again, it might not. Marketplace's Ashley Milne-Tite explains.
For one thing, there's the question of when this deal would go into effect. Robin Mills is CEO of Qamar Energy, an energy consulting firm in Dubai. He says Iran won't agree to freeze production. It's just ramping up after the end of sanctions. But nothing's going to happen without Iran.
And I think that's kind of understood by the other OPEC members, that they would have to reach some kind of agreement with Iran. I just don't think it'd be economically or politically possible for them to agree to freeze their production if Iran was completely free to do whatever it wanted.
He says OPEC countries have always had trouble coordinating among themselves, never mind when you bring in outside players like Russia. But if the freeze happens, he says, it will drive prices up eventually. Jason Bordoff isn't so sure. He directs the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. He says there's already a ton of oversupply waiting for consumers.
And the countries that have agreed to freeze production are already producing pretty close to the maximum they could produce anyway. So no one thought they were going to be producing a lot more.
Then there's the fact the US isn't part of this deal. Barbara Shook is with Energy Intelligence Group. She says if a freeze brings prices up, the US will start drilling and supply will swell again. She says there's one thing that would help.
Saudi Arabia is the only country that really matters as far as setting production. And unless Saudi Arabia decides to cut its output, then nothing is going to be permanent in the global market.
Last month, the Saudi oil minister said a cut was not going to happen. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
$34.50 for a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil at the close today in New York. That was up just a tetch. Equities-wise, a bumpy ride, also up just a tetch, as it turns out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Super Tuesdays in the books, the winners and not winners you know about already. Less often told, though, are the behind-the-scenes nuts and bolts stories, the grinded-out minutiae of politics that gets the votes cast. Every year, it seems, data plays a bigger and bigger part. How candidates use what they know about us. There are companies that provide that data that campaigns count on, the biggest of which, on the Democratic side anyway, is a company called NGP Van. Stu Trevelyan is the CEO of that company. Stu, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tell me what, in layman terms now, tell me what it is you guys do.
Well, so, you know, what we do is we make it so that campaigns can go out there and they can collect information at the door. So we were, for example, the first company to allow people to go door to door with, instead of, you know, soggy clipboards, with mobile devices, you know, back in the days of Palm Pilots. Remember those? Yeah. Anyway, so and so what we do is we help campaigns figure out which doors to knock on and what to say at those doors, what questions to ask. And then that data comes in and helps refine what doors get knocked on tomorrow and what gets asked tomorrow.
So the campaigns will actually sort of annotate that data.
Exactly. You know, there's been a lot of talk in, you know, in the press about sort of, you know, whether this type of voter is a whiskey drinker versus a gin drinker. But actually, the most important data in campaigns is observed data, right? When you ask a person what they're interested in, they'll tell you, you know, they're interested in these particular issues. And then you can take that and model out to similar people, right, and say they may also be interested in those things. Let's try and market to them about those issues.
And then groove marketing campaigns, advertising, all of that jazz to motivate those voters to come out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'm kind of old, you know, I've been around.
What are
you
like 40? Show?
47, right?
47,
you know?
All right.
And so, you know, I founded my first, you know, company that works with technology. The campaigns used to miss all these opportunities because they had silos in the various different categories of different databases. And so what we've been able to do is sort of bring that all together for clients so that they're able to see, all right, these volunteers, let's ask them for a small dollar contribution. Yeah. This blog commenter, let's ask them to volunteer, et cetera.
Isn't this a little bit like Moneyball and Sabermetrics? You guys are taking politics and taking the emotional guts out of it. And making it all, and you're smirking a little bit here. You can't decide if you're smiling or not.
Please. No, I'm just laughing because, you know, a lot of us actually in the field, you know, particularly those of us who are of a certain age, really were into baseball statistics. So, yeah, you're
so
exactly
it's intentional.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's intentional.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
We thought we could translate this to the political world, yeah.
Has it turned out the way you wanted it to? I mean, have you optimized it now?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of good trends, right? You know, if you look at how campaigns are financed and what candidates have to do with their time, right? You know, what you're seeing is there's the capability of collecting email addresses, asking people for money, rinse, repeat. That's meaning that candidates aren't having to spend as much time dialing for dollars, right? And also, we're able to make sure that things like voter turnout are higher, right? And that's a good thing for democracy. So, yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot of good things that have come about from technology being introduced to politics.
You guys are the 800-pound gorilla of this on the Democratic side, right?
A lot of people choose to work with us, yeah.
Okay, he says diplomatically. Not the case on the Republican side. Why do you suppose it's broken down that way?
Well, you know, some of it's actually the Republicans have tried to replicate what we've done. So, say, for example, they had a GOP data center, but it wasn't very good, so nobody used it. And then they tried to create GOP data beacon in the 2014 cycle, but they never quite finished that project and never put it out to market. You know, now the RNC CTO is on his own with a company named Republic trying to create another one. So basically, you know, what you've seen is they really haven't had any product that was head and shoulders enough of the others to have people coalesce around it.
Stu Trevelyan, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We have, I should tell you, invited Republican data companies to come on the program as well. Two more things now about the economics of American politics circa 2016 that the past 24 hours have brought us. First of all, Donald Trump in his victory speech last night saying this.
I was saying, make America great again. I actually think we can say now, and I really believe this, we're going to get things coming. We're going to get Apple to start building their damn computers and things in this country instead of in other countries.
As it happens, we did a story about what a U.S.-made iPhone would cost us, the U.S. consumer, not all that long ago. Here's a hint. More. It would cost us more. Item the second, Ben Carson. There is word today Dr. Carson is set to suspend his campaign. He's going to do it in a speech on Friday at the big conservative political action conference. Between now and then, take a listen to our interview with him back when he was up in the polls, way, way up. Both of those stories or at marketplace.org. You can hit the link over on the left-hand side of the page that says Mentioned on Air. We'll get the latest and greatest on the good but not quite good enough, still kind of bumpy labor market recovery on Friday morning. The February unemployment report is going to be upon us. We've added plus or minus 10 million new private sector jobs since the recession ended. Keyword there being private sector. Over in the public sector, government jobs, in other words, at the federal, state, and local level, it is a less pretty picture and one that has real implications for women and minorities and for the middle class writ large. From our desk up at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Let's look at the numbers. The economy started adding private sector jobs in 2010. We're now 5 million above the pre-recession peak. Government jobs, though, kept falling for several more years before starting to rebound, and were still down by 300,000. Steve Kreisberg is director of collective bargaining at AFSCME, the union representing more than a million public sector workers.
The public sector has been kind of the original equal opportunity employer. The loss of jobs has had a disproportionate impact on people of color and women because disproportionately, women and people of color were public employees.
Women suffered 70% of government layoffs, African Americans 20%, according to the Progressive Economic Policy Institute. And in time, the loss of jobs in teaching, social services, road and bridge maintenance, regulatory agencies will erode the middle class, says Rutgers University economist William Rogers.
Government jobs, particularly at the federal level, on average pay higher than in the private sector. And we're pulling back a disproportionate share of African Americans and women. We would then start to see wages of minorities and of women deteriorate.
And the impact of those government wages and benefits for minorities and women over a lifetime of work is considerable. Tomas Rivero knows this. Though he doesn't think much about it on the job, he's usually kind of busy.
Interior looks like it just laid back down. Copy, thank you.
Rivero is a wildland firefighter with the U.S. Forest Service, and what we're hearing is from a video a buddy shot of his crew attacking a flare-up. They were working a fire at Battle Mountain, Nevada. Rivero is 54. He lives in Portland, and he's been fighting fires for nearly 30 years.
It is a good income. You know, you can live very well.
Rivero can make $65,000 or $70,000 a year. Plus, there's a pension and health benefits. Very different from his early working life after arriving in the U.S. from Mexico, where he grew up.
Well, you know, I did, like, the most menial jobs. You know, I started as a janitor in Woolworths downtown L.A., and then I moved to a factory where we painted figurines, you know.
Working as a firefighter, Rivero eventually saved enough to buy a house. It's old, needs a lot of work, but he never could have afforded it as a janitor or figurine painter. More than a decade ago, Rivero was tapped to work on a local effort to recruit more young blacks and Hispanics from urban areas to these fire service jobs. But in recent years, he's seen government budget tightening shrink the firefighting ranks and reverse some of the progress that was made.
With the more availability of jobs, there was more diversity. But as the jobs started disappearing, you also start losing a lot of that diversity.
Plenty of economists would reject the notion that a healthy recovery requires employment in the public sector to grow as much or as fast as in the private sector. Conservative economists, budget hawks, generally favor job growth that is generated by for-profit businesses and not taxpayer-funded. But it's at least clear that some job seekers would like to have a shot at the kind of job and job security that government has historically provided. Sharon Peters is 52, African American. I met her at the Oregon Employment Office in Portland. She has a job in a newspaper plant. Now she's looking for better pay and benefits.
I would kind of like something with the state or the county.
Have you had any luck?
Well, I did apply, and there was, they get so many applicants.
Peter says her parents raised 13 kids on her father's pay as a merchant seaman and her mother's work, managing a daycare and a restaurant, and drawing a government paycheck running a program for disadvantaged youth. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's so many science fiction movies where, you know, where they stick a tracking device in someone. Well, guess what? It's real. It happened.
Tracking chips inside people. Think of it as tracking inventory in a twisted kind of way. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 34 points today, 0.2%, closed at 16,899. The NASDAQ up 13 points, also 0.2%, finished at 4703. The S&P 500 added 8 points, 0.4%, 1986 there. Energy stocks got a lift today. Murphy Oil up 12%. Marathon Oil added more than 14% today. Sports Authority filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Today, the sports retail company is privately held, but the news did influence some publicly traded companies in that arena. Big Five Sporting Goods shed more than 10%. Nike gave back 1% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We were talking about oil up at the top of the program and how too much supply and not enough demand have done a number on crude prices. It's a similar story in steel. The price has been plummeting, but there might be something more than just supply and demand 101 at work here. The Commerce Department says prices on some steel products coming from seven countries are too low, unfairly low in point of fact, and that the government's going to levy tariffs in response. Steel from China, cold-rolled steel to be specific, is going to have a whopping 266% duty tacked on. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
In the world of international trade, dumping is a big no-go. That's when you sell goods abroad for cheaper than in your domestic market, or when you sell stuff for less than it costs to make. Kind of simple.
Yeah, it's actually a two-part process. I'm sorry it's so complicated.
It always is. Gary Huffbauer is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Dumping has to cause injury to some U.S. industry.
If the government investigates and finds dumping, it can impose these tariffs to penalize foreign guys, protect the domestic ones, and try and get prices where they should be.
Steel products, chemicals, building materials, it's a huge range of manufactured goods covered by these kinds of orders.
Berndt Jansen, a partner at Akin Gump, says tariffs can stay in place for years. But our normal, everyday tariffs on goods coming into the country are typically pretty small, in the low single digits. For decades, the U.S. has been negotiating lower tariffs with other countries in exchange for similar reductions on their side.
The U.S. has among the most open markets in the world and among the lowest levels of tariffs.
So Ishwar Prasad, a trade policy professor at Cornell, says lots of manufacturers in particular would like to see the U.S. bring more of these types of cases.
And this argument has a lot of resonance at a time when, although the economy is doing quite well, there is still the perception that the manufacturing sector continues to hemorrhage jobs in the U.S. and that many of these jobs are being lost to foreign countries.
Especially with a big trade deal pending in Congress and lots of talk about trade on the presidential campaign. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
One of the hardest things to do in healthcare, in the actual medicine of it, is to get the diagnosis right. Doctors and nurses have to recognize the symptoms for what they are and then put their finger on the problem. That applies for individuals and in the aggregate, too. And increasingly, healthcare professionals are working to recognize and to treat victims of human trafficking. These are people who are tough to spot and even harder to help. In the first of three reports this week, our healthcare correspondent Dan Gorenstein is going to look at how the healthcare industry has started to realize the scope of the human trafficking problem. Here's Dan.
Dr. A rolls his eyes.
I run into this weird triage note on the board, and this one said, I have a tracker in me.
It's October 2015. Dr. A, we're not using his name or identifying his hospital to protect patient safety, is 28 years old and about as green as they come. And he's got a patient who claims she's got a GPS tracking device implanted in her side.
When you work on the east side of our hospital, psychiatric patients are a dime a dozen.
But this patient is different. She's put together, she's lucid, and she's got an incision. The doctor orders an x-ray. Dr. A says everybody crowds around the computer.
Embedded in the right side of her flank is a small metallic object, only a little bit larger than a grain of rice. But it's there. It's unequivocally there. She has the tracker in her. No one was speaking for... It had to be at least 5 seconds. And in an ER, in a busy ER, that's saying something.
It turns out this 20-something woman is being pimped out by her boyfriend, forced to sell herself for sex and hand him the money. A guy determined to keep her as his. Dr. A cuts out the device.
It was a small glass capsule with a little, almost like a circuit board inside of it. I took a picture of the device and showed it to my wife, who's a veterinary technician. It's an RFID chip. It's used to tag cats and dogs, and someone had tagged her like an animal, like she was somebody's pet that they owned.
This is human trafficking, an issue that hasn't been on much anyone's radar here in the U.S. Part of that is because few of us know what human trafficking, or modern-day slavery, actually means. Catherine Chan is the director of the newly created Office on Trafficking in Persons at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Very plainly, human trafficking is when one person takes advantage of another person for some type of profit or advantage.
That can literally mean being locked in a room or having a tracking chip injected under your skin. It can be subtle, like your employer holding your passport. It's found in industries from prostitution to manufacturing to domestic service. Breaking this cycle of violence traditionally has been left to law enforcement. But in just the last 3 years, people in healthcare are waking up to the fact that they can play a critical role.
I can guarantee you that I've placed my hands and I've examined and I've spoken to more trafficking victims than I know I have.
That's Wendy Macias, an ER doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Macias is one of the nation's leading advocates to get doctors, nurses, and hospital executives involved. One report finds as many as 88% of sex trafficking victims end up in ERs and clinics at some point while being held. Macias says, in a very different way than law enforcement, healthcare providers get these moments, sort of privileged access into the lives of people who are often out of reach.
Traffickers are really smart, and they will move their patients around from one city to the next all across the country. And I want us to be able to help them when we have them in our midst, because it may be the last time that they're there.
But here's the challenge. You've got to convince doctors and nurses that doctors and nurses are uniquely placed to break the cycle of violence. One study shows just 1/4 of providers think human trafficking touches their patients. The Justice Department, though, says 83% of confirmed sex trafficking victims are U.S. citizens. Dr. Dale Carrison at the University Medical Center in Las Vegas hopes the case with the tracking device is so disturbing it pushes people in healthcare to action.
There's so many science fiction movies where they stick a tracking device in someone. Well, guess what? It's real. It happened. And I think that was a big wake-up call for me personally that, we're going to another level now, and I need to get this word out to all my colleagues. Don't blow this off.
There are some signs of life. Money's beginning to flow to train clinicians to identify patients. More than half a dozen professional societies, including the American Medical Association, have passed resolutions highlighting the problem. The grassroots group HEAL, made up of some 600 providers, has formed. The first step is simple awareness. Knowledge has certainly helped change how Dr. A approaches his patients now.
It's always important to simply consider the possibility that something not obvious might be going on. I mean, recognizing that is the first step to being able to diagnose when you see it.
Since that October afternoon, Dr. A says he's pulled about 5 patients aside, checking for signs of trafficking. He's come up empty each time. He explains that's what he does, rule out the bad stuff. That, he says, is his job. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Thank you.
final note on the way out today, an ode to the disappeared icons of Yosemite National Park. At 12:01 yesterday morning, the contract for the outgoing concessionaire at Yosemite expired, and with the company went the rights of the government to use the names of some of the most well-known features of the park. Delaware North, the concessionaire in question, have filed trademark applications for, among other things, the name Yosemite National Park itself. Also, the Ahwahnee Hotel is now officially called the Majestic Yosemite Hotel. Curry Village is now Half Dome Village. The list goes on. The Park Service, I should tell you, has filed an application with the Patent and Trademark Office to cancel those trademarks that Delaware North got. So, you know, fingers crossed. All right, we got to go. Equities up today, just a hair. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back in L.A. tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.